Tuesday, December 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, a judge prepares to sentence former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. A United Nations brokered truce begins in Yemen. And it's Christmas all year round at a store in Michigan. It's all ahead. President Donald Trump's former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn is awaiting sentencing for lying to investigators about his contacts with Russia in the weeks before Trump assumed power in early 2017. On Twitter today, Trump wished Flynn good luck before the sentencing. Special Counsel Robert Mueller has recommended that the 60-year-old Flynn, a retired Army general and once head of the country's Defense Intelligence Agency, not be sentenced to any prison time because of his substantial cooperation with prosecutors, although it will be up to U.S. District Judge Emmett Sullivan to decide his sentence. National correspondent Jim Malone joins me in the studio. And as I said, this is a developing story. Jim, this, of course, is occurring as Mueller's Russia probe continues. This is very significant for the Trump administration.
It is. I mean, Michael Flynn was a key Trump advisor during the 2016 campaign on foreign policy. And what he has pled guilty to previously was lying about his contacts with the then Russian ambassador to the United States, Sergei Kislyak, during the presidential transition time before Donald Trump took the oath of office in January of 2017. So Flynn has also been cooperating with the special counsel investigation. They said he's been cooperating on the issue of whether or not there was collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign. And the interesting thing here is, and we don't have very much information on this at all, he's cooperating on what are described as two other criminal investigations that are not detailed in any way. In fact, in the court documents, they're actually blacked out.
Yeah.
So we don't know what all that is. There's a bit of mystery there. But certainly, from the point of view of Robert Mueller, the special counsel, Flynn has been cooperating quite a bit. In fact, they detail the fact that he's, you know, met with prosecutors 19 times to offer cooperation. And we expect that will factor into what is expected to be a light sentence, if any sentence at all.
It seems that this really does have to do more with the Trump campaign in a way, because Flynn only served less than a month on this job.
Right. And I think one of the things they want to know is, during that early period, was Flynn aware of anything that may be related to conversations with the president or that he witnessed with others that could even get at the issue of whether or not there was some sort of obstruction of justice going on in the early stages of the administration before the appointment of a special counsel? So that's one area we want to know more about in terms of Michael Flynn. And just think, in the last 2 weeks, I mean, last week we had Michael Cohen.
Yes.
The president's former personal attorney, someone intimately familiar with President Trump and his business dealings going back many years. He was sentenced to 3 years in prison, offering some cooperation to prosecutors, but in other areas, not enough in their view. But certainly you get the sense, Sarah, of this investigation ramping up in a serious way. And, you know, where is it headed in 2019? A lot of people are speculating it could be headed to some sort of conclusion.
Although Cohen, I believe, was found guilty. It's more to do, in part, to doing with payments to women who have claimed affairs with Trump before Trump was in office, not so much dealing with the Russia investigation, as far as we know.
Well, he had a little bit to offer, apparently, on the Russia probe, talking about a building that the president was interested in constructing in Russia during the campaign, and various accounts of that, and Cohen apparently lying to Congress about that. But you're right. The real focus there was the alleged campaign violations, finance violations, the payments to two women. And there's been, you know, a lot of legal scholars have thought that, again, the president could be liable in some way there in terms of possible criminal involvement in terms of authorizing those payments. Again, the president has maintained all along he was not aware of it and did not authorize the payments, though to some extent the explanations have shifted a bit over time. But all of this comes, of course, as Democrats prepare to take over the House of Representatives, and we expect perhaps several oversight investigations, and certainly they'll be offering support for continuation of the Russia investigation.
During President Trump's 2016 presidential campaign, I believe that Flynn would go to a number of rallies that the president had and actually participated in, if not led, some of these chants about Hillary Clinton, who was then running against Trump, charges of saying, lock her up, for her alleged activities at various parts in her career.
Right. Well, you know, he was a very respected general in the military and was seen as quite an innovative combat leader in terms of countering terrorism around the world. And even some associates have kind of wondered how he kind of made this transformation from seemingly for most of his career a sort of nonpartisan, non-political type person to very much a critic of the Obama-Clinton sort of policies of the previous administration and emerging as a real kind of cheerleader for President Trump. And as you said, there's numerous depictions of him on video leading the chants to have Clinton locked up, especially during the Republican convention in 2016.
I believe I just saw a message here on the studio saying that apparently the court session will resume in about 20 minutes. So I think we're going to have to wait a bit longer. But thanks very much, Jim. That's national correspondent Jim Malone. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley urges Palestinians to accept a peace deal with Israel. Arizona Congresswoman Martha McSally is named a U.S. Senator for that state. Cambodians fight back as deportations escalate, and Poland reverses a lower age limit for judges. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Each of Earth's living beings has a built-in biological clock that functions over a 24-hour cycle. The so-called circadian clock is a well-regulated biological process which helps keep our bodies healthy by regulating tasks such as sleeping, waking, body temperature, and other important functions. Now a group of scientists at Chicago's Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine have developed what they call the first simple blood test that will tell what time it is according to your body's internal clock. Called Time Signature, the test will provide researchers new insight into the impact of unsynchronized internal clocks on a wide range of diseases. One day, this test could become an important part of personalized medicine, helping your doctor determine when you should be taking your medications and other important health decisions. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the United Nations says migrants must be protected and treated with dignity and respect. We'll have a report. Despite clashes in the early hours of a Yemen ceasefire over the port city of Hodeidah, calm was reported Tuesday as the UN-brokered truce began, one of the confidence-building measures to emerge from last week's talks in Sweden. The cost of 3 years of conflict in combatants and civilians between Houthi rebels and a Saudi-led coalition backing the Yemen government has surpassed 60,000. The assessment of the years 2016 to 2018 was made by the UK-based research data collecting group Armed Conflict Location and Event Data, or ACLED. It is a dramatic rise from the oft-quoted UN figure of 10,000 put out nearly 3 years ago. Braden Fuller is an ACLED assistant research manager. Speaking to International Edition's Victor Beatty from Provol, Utah, Fuller said it's been difficult to collect accurate data on the fatalities from the four-year conflict.
It's a lot of chaos on the ground, a lot of difficulty researching, but we feel like our number is quite accurate as we use local sources and local teams. And again, this is just an estimate, these numbers. So we have a hard time in very rural areas and things like that, but we believe that our number is quite accurate in that respect.
This is more than just civilians, but it's fighters as well, both together.
About one-tenth of the fatalities in our estimate are civilians, about around 6,000. Civilians, most of those are killed by the Saudi-led coalition in airstrikes or missile strikes, but also the Houthis in the form of landmines, shelling, artillery, have killed quite a few civilians as well.
This is just for the last 3 years, I guess, but the conflict has been raging since 2014. What happened to the figures for that year and for 2015?
We began collecting fatality and other data on the Yemen conflict in 2016, and we're currently working on backcoding. Our 2015 data will be published soon, and we'll go back and hopefully be able to provide numbers for 2014 as well. So these numbers only include 2016 to present.
We can expect this 60,000-plus figure to increase dramatically, perhaps.
We would estimate at the current rate that the figure could reach up to around 75,000 fatalities. These figures represent fatalities that occurred during armed conflict only or protest events. This figure does not include people who were killed as a result of cholera, sickness, malnutrition.
Did you notice a spike in the figures, say, in the last year or two?
We did. Since the assault on the port city Hodeida, we've seen a major escalation in violence. We saw an 820% increase in total conflict-related fatalities as of 2018, which represented a major increase, 68% increase across all of the governance in Yemen since the first 11 months of 2018.
Braden Fuller of ACLED. ACLED said nearly 40% of total civilian fatalities in Yemen this year died in the assault on Hodeida. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council has taken up a draft resolution that asks Secretary General Antonio Guterres to submit proposals by the end of the month on how to monitor the ceasefire around the port city following talks in Sweden between the Houthi rebels and Saudi coalition-backed government. The United States Tuesday agreed to grant a visa to a Yemeni woman in Egypt whose child is dying in California. Shama Swaleh was told she can travel to California, where her 2-year-old son, Abdullah Hassan, is in a hospital with a fatal medical condition. I spoke with Bassem Alkara, executive director of the Sacramento chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. He tells me about the U.S. decision to grant the visa.
Yes, this just happened. She literally walked out of the U.S. Embassy in Cairo about an hour ago with visa in hand.
Hopefully, I'm sure her plans are to travel as soon as possible to see her son. Where is he currently?
He's in Oakland, at UCSF in Oakland.
Now, how did it come in this case? Why has she been separated from her husband and her son?
Because she is a Yemeni national married to a U.S. citizen, and they applied, and then the Muslim ban took effect, and so which did not allow her to migrate here.
What is the child's medical condition?
He has a degenerative brain disease, and it's gone to a point where, you know, the doctors wanted to pull him off life support. They actually wanted to pull him off life support a few days ago until a social worker from the hospital called our office, and we just said, give us a few days, and we'll get on it right away to try to bring the mom to see her son in his last moments. And the doctors agreed, and it's been a very intense 24 hours, but It happened. It happened. And even though we're excited, you know, in this win, it's still a loss at the end. But at least she can come here and mourn her son, see him one last time before life support is pulled. And and have her mourn in dignity.
What was the reason that the U.S. government originally denied her being able to come to the United States?
Due to the Muslim ban. Yemen is one of the countries in the Muslim ban, and so that's the reason why they denied her.
I guess, though, the child at this point is not conscious.
You know, I was able to visit him on Sunday. He does, you know, when his father touched him, he moved. So, you know, he still has life in him. But he's, you know, his situation is dire, but he still has life in him. And I think he will feel his mother's presence when she speaks to him, when she touches him.
All right. Well, thank you. This is such a sad story, but at least it's an improved ending.
And we thank everyone at the State Department that expedited this and made this happen. We thank them.
Bassem El-Kara, Executive Director of the Sacramento Branch of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. President Trump introduced the travel ban on majority Muslim countries soon after taking office in January 2017. It forbids travel to the United States by citizens of 5 majority Muslim countries: Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. Tuesday is International Migrants Day, and the head of the UN Migration Agency is urging nations to drop their negative perceptions of migrants and to treat them with dignity, respect, and as a benefit to their societies. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the agency's headquarters in Geneva.
When the United Nations proclaimed December 18th as International Migrants Day in 2000, around 150 million people were on the move. Now, 18 years later, that number has grown to an estimated 258 million. Many people migrate to other nations for economic reasons, because they are desperately poor, are running from violence, or are imbued with a sense of adventure and entrepreneurship. The United Nations reports another 40 million people are internally displaced by conflict. International Organization for Migration Director General Antonio Vitorino says many people do not wish to leave their homes, but are compelled to do so by circumstances out of their control. For example, he says every year millions of people are forced to leave by climate-related disasters and natural hazards. His spokesman, Joel Millman, says IOM Chief Vitorino notes the mere act of migration exposes many people to great dangers.
IOM's data show that close to 3,400 migrants and refugees have already lost their lives worldwide in 2018. Most died trying to reach Europe by sea. Many others perished attempting to cross deserts or pass through dense forests seeking safety far from official border crossings. These numbers, compiled daily by IOM staff, shame us.
This year's observance of International Migrants Day comes one day ahead of the formal endorsement at the UN General Assembly of the Global Compact for Migration. The compact was overwhelmingly adopted by most nations in the world earlier this month in Marrakesh, Morocco. Major holdouts include Australia, the United States, Hungary, Italy, Austria, and Poland. Vitorino sees the agreement as an important step toward providing the dignity owed to migrants. He says it also creates a space wherein a more balanced discourse and widespread cooperation on migration can take place. He says the compact stresses the need for all states to have well-managed migration. He adds no one state alone can achieve this. He says cooperation at all levels is fundamental to addressing migration. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. At more than one hectare under one roof, Bronner's Christmas Wonderland promotes itself as the largest Christmas store in the world. Erica Celeste visited the store in Frankenmuth, Michigan, for a tour through the eyes of some of its smallest customers, children.
Wow, this is really new.
Visiting Bronner's Christmas Wonderland is more than a shopping trip. It's an experience. At roughly the size of 8 Olympic swimming pools, it's a lot for 10-year-old Rain Martorello and her little brother Roland to grasp.
It's huge. That's all I can say. It's really huge.
She's right. The entire Bronner property sits on 18 hectares, with more than half devoted to buildings for design and storage. There's also a replica of the Silent Night Chapel from Oberndorf, Austria, a monument to the popular Christmas carol.
Oh my gosh!
But the kids are more interested in shopping.
Look at that!
A trip to Bronner's often starts with a commemorative photo behind a huge Christmas wreath. From there, customers are given a map to help navigate the store. Dazzling lights and outdoor decor cascade from the ceiling, which had to be raised to accommodate taller Christmas tree displays.
Mom?
What?
We found a weird one over here in the grave.
8-year-old Rollins says the old-fashioned Dickens characters, Christmas villages, and nutcrackers that cover the showroom floor are nice, but he prefers things like the modern electronic snowman with LED lights that sings. From stockings to Santa suits and everything in between, Media Relations Chief Lori Libka says Bronner's has something to please everyone.
We have just over 50,000 items here. Everything from artificial trees and wreaths and garlands, all kinds of lighting, the LED lights. We have ornaments. We have about 8,000 styles of ornaments. About 1,500 of those can be personalized.
She adds that the ornaments are the stars of the store. Everything from hand-blown glass baubles to sports-themed pieces and even movie motif ornaments. A definite favorite are the international ornaments, which makes sense because visitors from more than 100 countries have signed the store's guestbook.
We do see a lot of international folks, and it's not unusual to walk around and to hear several languages being spoken any given day this time of year.
Founder Wally Bronner was a teenager when he started a sign painting business. After a businessman asked him to create Christmas signs for the city of Clare, Michigan, he recognized a niche market and in 1945 opened a store specializing in the holiday. It's still owned by the family. His children and grandchildren are now in charge. Because faith and family were important to him, Bronner worked tirelessly to blend the religious meaning of Christmas with the commercial aspect. He also made sure Bronner's was a place for customers of all ages to enjoy. That's why young customers who need a break from shopping can visit with Santa.
You know, I like being at Bronner's because it gives me a chance to really talk about what Christmas means. You know, and I give out one of those little ornaments that has Mary and Joseph and the baby Jesus.
Because the store is open 361 days a year, it's the one place where kids of all ages can get a little Christmas, including decorated holiday cookies from the Bronner family recipe, at any time they want.
What do I get then?
For VOA News, I'm Erica Celeste in Frankenmuth, Michigan.
Making some nice Christmas memories there. Well, that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
VOAAfrica.com. If you want to learn more about the news stories that change the world, we invite you to visit our webpage, VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
To find the latest news, look in the upper right-hand corner of the page. You can read the news updates around the clock. VOA Africa,
on the air, online, mobile.